This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin this week and this hour talking about a war between the states, not likely to end up as some Ken Burns miniseries. More on that in just a moment. We're going to recall, though, this hour, how much anti-poverty policy is based on flawed psychiatric analysis from the last century of the consequences of being poor, analysis that has really complicated our discussions of race and class in America even today, diagnosing the poor as opposed to helping them. That's later this hour. We'll also discuss the virtues of holiday texts, holiday Facebook statuses, Flickr, group emails, or the very retro holiday card with an actual postal stamp on it, the etiquette of a digital Christmas. And we want you to participate in that conversation, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. What's your sense of digital etiquette during the holiday, which is very much gone digital? But first, two big environmental stories this week that have pitted one set of states against another in a case or a set of cases that could reopen the old acid rain wars from a generation ago. Joining us now, Coral Davenport, energy and environment correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Coral, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's great to be here, John.
So first of all, we've got states petitioning other states to the EPA directly to try to get standards changed to prevent pollution coming from one region from having an impact on another region. It does sound like the old acid rain wars. What's different about what's going on right now this week?
Well, John, the dynamic is pretty much exactly the same as the acid rain wars. And what happened with the acid rain wars is that they worked. The states were compelled to shut down a lot of their pollution, and acid rain is not a major problem in the U.S. anymore. But there are a lot of other major pollution problems, and so we're seeing the exact same dynamic. And this is pollution from coal plants, tailpipes, factories from the Midwest, which has looser, more lenient air quality standards than the East Coast, blowing east, blowing to the Atlantic seaboard. And what is happening is the Northeast and East Coast states have much tighter air control standards. And the governors of those states are saying, as tight as our standards are, we've done everything we can to clean up our air. We've got, you know, mandatory emissions tests. We've installed scrubbers. We've cleaned up everything we can. And yet we still have some of the dirtiest air in the country. And the tests show that up to half of that pollution is coming from out of state, is coming from the West and also Appalachia, the Southeast. So today, the governors of eight Northeastern, New England, and Mid-Atlantic states are petitioning the EPA to force new air pollution controls on states in the Midwest. This is the Rust Belt, basically, Ohio, Michigan, coal country, Kentucky, West Virginia, these states that produce a lot more pollution, which is, you know, blowing west and polluting the air of the east.
Now, what's the argument of the states in the Rust Belt, and how does this have an impact on the Supreme Court also this week, apparently going to rule on the so-called good neighbor rule from the Obama administration, which gives states a certain amount of responsibility here?
Right. So this is all part of the same dynamic. I mean, the dynamic is that some states have looser air control standards than others. And they're, you know, the federal government for decades has acknowledged that there's a problem of this pollution going from, you know, dirtier air states and blowing next door into other states. So the Obama administration has put out a regulation known as the Good Neighbor Rule, which basically says, you know, the states with the more heavily polluting plants are going to have to cut their pollution. If there is evidence that the pollution is going into crossing state lines, then those states will have to shut down coal plants, install expensive controls, do what they can to clean up their act. And that regulation was thrown out by D.C. Circuit Court. The Supreme Court is taking it up tomorrow. And that's, you know, that regulation is very much, you know, also opens up that dynamic of the Northeast and the Eastern states pitted against the Rust Belt, coal country, the Southeast. And the dynamic actually comes back to an interesting fact of nature I learned while reporting this story, which is simply this. Wind blows across the continental U.S. from west to east. So generally, Midwestern states enjoy nice, fresh air blown in from the Mountain West, that wind keeps going through the Rust Belt, through the part of America that has the most coal plants and the most factories, and blowing it east to the East Coast and the Northeast. So this is a long-standing problem.
The prevailing westerlies. I learned about them in elementary school. Final thought here. I mean, when we talk about the Supreme Court and the EPA and states' rights and the fact that only Democrats have signed on to this petition, are we seeing this year a partisan issue where the EPA is becoming the target of anti-environmentalists or Republican challenges to suggest that the EPA doesn't have the authority to regulate these state-to-state kinds of issues, doesn't have the authority to regulate carbon even? Is that what this year is going to be about?
Absolutely. And by this year, I'll say, 2014 going into the midterm elections, EPA has been for a while a top target of Republicans and also of the coal industry. I'm sure you remember the argument during the 2012 campaign that President Obama and the EPA are, quote-unquote, waging war on coal. As these EPA regulations continue, we're absolutely going to see that. I mean, this is a fight that is about the federal government and regulation pitted against these industries that are tied in many ways to red states. So we will absolutely see this political fight play out as well.
She's energy and environment correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, Coral Davenport. Thanks so much.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, John.
In the annals of environmental disasters, the case of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska in 1989 was certainly one of the worst. A tanker spill that made clear how vulnerable the environment is to the transport of fossil fuels, let alone the burning of them for energy.
One of America's most magnificent waterways is blackened and befouled tonight by the biggest oil spill in American history.
The Retro Report documentary team's focus this week is to look back at the impact of the huge amount of oil released into Alaska's Prince William Sound when the Exxon Valdez tanker broke up in Alaskan waters. Scott Michaels, reporter for Retro Report, sent a team back to Alaska to see evidence of the spill and to find any signs in the industry of lessons learned.
I mean, at the time, it was really a devastating event. There were 11 million gallons of oil spilled. More than 200,000 birds were killed, several thousand other otters and other types of marine animals. So, I mean, it was a huge event, and it was something that impacted the community there for decades to come.
One of the voices in your report is Ricky Ott, who's an environmental activist. Listen.
Prince William Sound is not the same as it was. The environment still has not fully recovered, and we're over two decades into this now.
Exxon spent more than $2 billion cleaning up the spill, but there is still oil there buried beneath the surface of some of the beaches. It's a comparatively small amount compared to the amount that was spilled, but the oil seems to be degrading at a very slow rate, so that if you dig beneath the surface of some of the beaches, you can actually still come across what appears to be fresh oil.
And economically speaking, you don't have to be an environmentalist to understand that the impacts are still being felt. Here's fisherman Mike Weber.
The community is still very depressed. 500 people left. That's a lot in a small community. I'll never recover from the oil spill.
Prince William Sound is a fishing community, and a lot of fishermen went into financial debt after the spill. And because the lawsuit against Exxon dragged on for so long, it wasn't resolved until almost 20 years after the spill. The fact that it took so long really made it much more difficult for people there to move on, both financially and emotionally.
A lot of what the principal value of Retro Report is that you get to see a story in a different light. How do you see the Exxon Valdez disaster differently?
The thing that I sort of had remembered from just hearing about it was that the captain had been drinking, and that was sort of the cause of the accident. I think that's something that probably the one thing that most people recall from that.
The human error.
Yeah, the human error. And I think that was really a very small part of what actually caused this. There's a much bigger breakdown in the system that was meant to protect against these kind of accidents and against these kind of spills.
And the question is, were lessons learned particularly in light of subsequent, much more recent disasters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the lessons were learned and some were not. In the wake of the Exxon Valdez, new legislation was passed to deal with oil tanker spills and to improve safety in that regard. But the legislation really didn't deal with other aspects of the oil industry, such as offshore oil drilling. And the other big issue is in terms of the response to major spills. You know, the equipment and the technology used to respond to them really hasn't improved a whole lot since 1989. And then when you came to the Deepwater Horizon spill in 2010, you know, really they were using basically the same kinds of tools to deal with the oil once it had been released into the environment.
And, you know, one of the most interesting voices in this story is Bob Graham, who's co-chairman of the National Commission on that BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill, talking about sort of what's transpired since the Exxon Valdez. Here, listen.
I used the phrase that the offense got way ahead of the defense. The potential risk had increased dramatically, but there'd been no commensurate increase in our capability to avoid an accident or to respond to it.
So he sees it clearly. The technology to clean up had not improved, and yet the risk had increased because of the proliferation of offshore drilling platforms and the proliferation, let's just say it, of tankers.
In the years running up to the Deepwater Horizon spill, there had been a pretty significant expansion in offshore oil drilling and an expansion into deeper and deeper waters, and that brought with it an increased risk that you might have a worst-case scenario spill like this. And I think that the sense of Senator Graham and, you know, the other congressmen who have looked into this is the money and the attention that was being paid to thinking about how are we going to respond to a worst-case scenario spill really wasn't adequate to the risk that was there.
And still isn't.
Yeah, I mean, since then, there have been, you know, the government and the oil industry have spent quite a bit of money to come up with a way to cap deep water wells. So there have been new commitments to spend money and to be prepared. But, you know, the next accident may be completely different. And just like during that, right in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez, a number of people who looked at the incident said, well, you should, you know, recognize that the next oil industry accident, you know, may be a very different type of accident. So, you know, since the Deepwater Horizon spill, there has been more money to deal with a deepwater blowout, but there are other areas of the oil industry and other risks.
And the cleanup technology has not really changed that much. We saw the same, you know, being used in the Gulf as was used in Alaska. Some questionable chemicals added to the mix, but still the technology roughly the same.
Right, yeah.
Scott Michaels, reporter for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a unique historical look through a doctor's eyes of America's attempts to deal with the policy of poverty reduction, from treating poor people like a diagnosis to describing it as a war on poverty. All complications, and that's coming up in just a moment here on The Takeaway. America's approaches to poverty went from pure charity to pure policy back in the 1960s.
Your imagination and your initiative and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our needs, or a society where old values and new visions are buried under unbridled growth.
That's Lyndon Johnson declaring a war on poverty in a speech at the University of Michigan in May of 1964. The transition was quick, and aside from churches and charities with real experience dealing with the poor, there were few policymakers with experience with the urban poor to begin to define the problems and make meaningful changes. This began an alliance between psychiatry and politics, the echoes of which can be heard today in our policies for the poor even now. The poor and their deprivations constitute a kind of mental deficit that must be fought like a disease rather than an economic condition. This theme in poverty programs in America is the subject of a new book by a historian and a doctor who believes that trying to diagnose the poor has complicated our efforts to help them. Joining us is Michal Raz, medical historian and doctor and author of What's Wrong with the Poor? Psychiatry, Race, and the War on Poverty. Mikhail, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, it's interesting to me that a doctor's perspective and a historian's perspective really comes up with this particular truth here on anti-poverty programs and how psychology and psychiatry has really influenced them. How do you think your perspective is unique here?
Well, I think having worked with disadvantaged populations and having taken care of underserved individuals, men and women, in Israel in an underfunded clinic, I can really identify with the complexities of taking care of disadvantaged men and women without pathologizing them. It's a huge challenge because there are obviously things these men and women don't have and things they need. But as providers, we have to be sure we're giving them what they need and not what we think they don't have.
Let's focus on a program like the Head Start program and some of the motivations for early interventions in poverty populations. There is a temptation, and you describe it very eloquently, and it's frightening, really, to see, to cast people in the poor population as having some sort of deprivation problem, almost a form of mental retardation.
That's true, because when you look at a disadvantaged population, it's very easy to focus on what's wrong with individual children. What are they missing? What don't they have? Why don't they look like more advantaged children? But the question should be different. The question should be, what is the structural barriers in society that don't allow these children to participate in full? What's so seductive about the theory that Project Head Start is built on is its simplicity. They don't have something, let's give it to them. It's sort of like vitamin deficiency. Let's give them an extra dose of vitamins. They don't have a loving, nurturing mother at home, so let's put them in a classroom where a well-educated white woman could provide them with the care that we would expect them to have in a middle-class home.
Now, supplying some of those things that were absent certainly makes some sense, but coming along with that are a whole other set of attitudes about the poor which constrain our ability to reach poor families going forward. How did that come about?
No, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. I think Project Head Start is a wonderful program. And I would imagine that if I were involved in the 60s in education, I'd be interested in taking part in such a fantastic program where you provide low-income children with educational opportunities. But the problem is the presuppositions that these opportunities were based on, that they don't know their names, so let's display their names publicly so that they can learn their names. They've never seen a flower. No one ever spoke to them full sentences. These are all stereotypes that once you perpetuate them with this program and its theoretical underlyings, then you're stuck in looking at all the time at what's wrong with poor children.
Let me read a part of your book here. These are individuals who have the best reputations in terms of developing poverty programs and policies. The intellectual and sensory poverty of the African-American child's environment was a significant source of developmental disadvantage. Like many before him, Silberman, and this is the individual who you're quoting here, argued that low-income homes were in effect nonverbal. Adults spoke in monosyllables. Children there never heard several sentences spoken consecutively. And he concluded that to reverse the effects of a starved environment, the school should begin as early as age 3. Now, why would that be true for the poor and not true for basically any child?
That's amazing, because you'd think that if public policymakers thought that early education is useful, they would think it's useful for everyone. If it's like an unmitigated good, then everyone should have advantage of it. But that really wasn't the case. It was seen as being good only for those children who weren't getting what they should be getting at home. For white middle-class children, it was a disadvantage because you were taking them away from their competent mother. So it was stratified between for race and class.
So how do you design policy that's not going to cast people paternalistically as essentially deprived to the point of affecting their children's mental health, still help children and actually make an impact on poverty?
I think that's, you know, the biggest question. And there's no easy solution. But I think there are clear pitfalls we have to avoid. We cannot pathologize poor men and women in order to argue that they need more services or more help. Discourse is really ingrained in our culture. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich talked about children who did not have the experience, quote, of seeing people get up and going to work on Monday. And then he suggested that children would be hired as assistant janitors in school. This is obviously clearly misguided, but it's based on the same principles that these children are missing positive role models or missing experiences at home. We have to move away from this model and focus on what children have and how we can utilize these advantages to help to further help them in their development.
You know, when Newt Gingrich made that remark, I remember he said that there should be apprenticeships for young, poor children to give them a sense of the work ethic culture. And when you heard those remarks, did you really see specific echoes of this attempt to pathologize and diagnose as opposed to make social policy when it comes to poor people?
Absolutely. Missing these experiences echoes exactly of the same deprivation discourse of the 60s. And the idea that there's a lack of work ethic rather than a lack of job opportunities or this discrimination that bars certain people from participating in the workforce is exactly focusing on the individual barriers rather than the structural barriers.
Michal Raz, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So the second installment of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine is continuing unabated. It's a battle for the soul of the nation. The sound in Kiev there, protesters smashing a statue of the Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin, a symbol of the Soviet dominance of Ukraine during the Cold War. The latest protest was the largest yet in almost 3 weeks, calling for the ouster of President Viktor Yanukovych's government and his policies of embracing Russia. David Herzenhorn, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins us from the site of the protests in Kiev. David, welcome back.
Good to be with you, John.
So this is a fight for the soul of the nation. Are things escalating? And is this students only or is it students and workers? What's the coalition of protesters like?
No, this is an absolutely broad coalition of folks representing the entire spectrum of Ukrainian society at this point, from Kiev, the capital, from the west, very close to the Polish border, from the south, from the east, which is predominantly seen as close to Russia. It's really quite a broad coalition of Ukrainians. And as you said, they're fighting for something. It's quite different from the Orange Revolution in 2004, which was about a disputed election, responding to fraudulent election results where there was an easy answer, a revote that took place, they got a different result that was regarded as fair, and the country moved on. At this point, what we're seeing is thwarted aspirations for a better quality of life that many saw as coming from this agreement with Europe, and Russia interfering with that, pressuring Yanukovych to ditch those accords. What we saw last night on Sunday was not only the biggest crowds, just a tremendous outpouring of hundreds of thousands of people, but the authorities really seem to lose control of the capital. Swarms of people all across the city, not just the toppling of the statue, but in fact, spontaneous demonstrations popping up all over the place, demonstrators planting tents at strategic intersections, blocking off streets close to the presidential administration, really seizing control of a large swath of the city.
Is it the case that Ukrainians look west and see prosperity and look east and see only repression?
They look east and they see a history that they know all too well and that they're not too excited about. They look west and they're not all that confident. They're actually quite apprehensive. They don't think the path to Europe is necessarily an easy one for Ukraine. They know their country is in deep financial trouble. They worry that, in fact, Europe may have much more to gain from closer relations with Ukraine than Ukraine has, at least in the short term. But at the same time, they're looking toward progress. A lot of these folks, as you mentioned, are young students who grew up in a post-communist society who have a very different plan for their lives than what was experienced by their parents and grandparents. And for them, the road to Europe, even if it's tough, even if it's difficult, is the way toward a better future.
Under a minute now, Yanukovych, he's a wily politician. He's been through this before. Are his tactics likely to work?
Well, we've seen him come back from the 2004 Orange Revolution, which was focused on him. He had won that race fraudulently, only to make a comeback in 2010. Now, as his country is protesting, he takes off to China, stops in Russia to meet Vladimir Putin. He's brazen, we can say that for sure. Now, today, he's agreed to roundtable talks pushed by his three predecessors, three former presidents of Ukraine, and we'll see what comes out of that. But as he said, he's a survivor.
David Herzenhorn on the latest from Kiev, the uprising in Ukraine. David, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
David Herzenhorn is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. A very different moment of truth for the nation of Syria in a year where the mission to eradicate chemical weapons from the world has taken an enormous step forward, even if the progress in the civil war has been hard to see. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons won the Nobel Peace Prize for its work in the raging battlefields of Syria. More work to be done. It will be completed as part of a remarkable collaboration between the United Nations and the OPCW. The UN Special Coordinator for the joint mission is Sigrid Kaag, who spoke very candidly about an amazing year and the sobering challenges of trying to work in a war zone and retain the identity of being neutral.
I lead the joint OPCW-UN mission, but I come at it as a UN staff member, but I can only be, as a colleague in the international community, can only be in admiration and awe of the very quiet and silent and highly technical work OPCW has carried out throughout the years. The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, is the accolade on years of work, achievement, and an important contribution to the non-proliferation agenda where chemical weapons are concerned.
How much of the Syrian experience do you think is an outlier, a one-time experience, and how much of what you're learning now and what you're experiencing in this collaboration is going to be passed on to future dealings with weapons of mass destruction?
Well, OPCW is operating on the basis of the convention, and state parties, when they declare their chemical weapons arsenal and they accede to the convention and obviously ratify and want to implement the elimination of the chemical weapons program, there's a whole process for that. OPCW supports a number of countries in this regard. It verifies and inspects. So I think the Syria experience, what you're probably hinting at, is really the collaboration between OPCW and UN in a very unique but very challenging setting where a country at war, under civil war conditions, has actually acceded to the convention and is in full implementation of the elimination of its chemical weapons program. The UN and OPCW have other experiences of collaboration, for instance, in Libya and in Iraq, but it's a different model. Here we are truly integrated in a joint mission, and I'm very honored to be to lead the mission in country.
I mean, in many ways, you're writing the rule book for future generations of how to deal in the middle of a war with something like this.
Well, I wouldn't call that a rule book. As you know, it's an unprecedented effort under unprecedented circumstances. So I'm not quite sure if one would necessarily seek to repeat this. However, we are experiencing and we're learning as we apply. And with the support of the Security Council and the international community, we are obviously forging ahead. But I wouldn't call it a rule book.
Is there a place, a location, a facility that you want to go to that you haven't been able to go to yet?
Well, the inspectors, the joint mission personnel, they verify and inspect all the declared sites. There are three sites we have not been able to physically inspect. Two, however, we've been able to verify. And that means we have designated cameras that are given to Syrian personnel that have gone to verify, to demonstrate to the joint mission what is there in terms of chemical agents and to give us the information that is needed to give guidance on the correct removal to out of country as part of the overall removal of the most harmful chemical agents. There is one site we have neither been able to verify nor inspect. Inspection means physical presence. So that is still pending, but we are hopeful that ultimately we'll get there. The risks are twofold. One of them is the inability to access because the security conditions are such it is potentially in opposition-held territory, so the government can't go. And under the convention, it is the government responsibility and role to not only create access, but also to be responsible for the elimination of the chemical weapons program. Secondly, we have a number of concerns, and that applies not only to the joint mission staff, but to the humanitarian actors that are working in Syria. You know, it's hard under very challenging circumstances. I come from a humanitarian background. It's very hard not to be affected or impacted, and that's why you need to rise above the level of what any individual may feel and be very clear on what you're doing for other people. Others suffer. We are there to alleviate that. We are there to make Syria and the region a somewhat safer place through the elimination of chemical weapons.
Somewhat safer place. We'll have to accept that here in this very, very difficult century. We can certainly admire your work and your mission, though, and congratulate you on a very, very historic year, Sigurd Kog.
Thank you.
This clunky sound, listen carefully, is from the 90s. A VHS cassette being sucked into a player. Got any VHS tapes at home somewhere? Remember Be Kind, Rewind? Now it's a wonder any of the cassettes even play anymore. Same with laser discs, floppy discs, scratchy vinyl records, anybody? Media formats take over and then get supplanted by upgraded technology. And then they're left victim to the chemical processes that produce entropy and degradation in everything. Those processes take their course and eventually make these individual items unplayable, just objects. What about the original motion picture format of all time, silent pictures? You can still see the original silent picture, Metropolis, Fritz Lang, an art piece about the 20th century and the degradation of man in the face of industrialization. This is the original score. But much of the silent era in film has vanished. The Library of Congress reported this month that 75% of the 10,000 or so silent films made between 1912 and 1929 are completely lost to history, burned or disintegrated without proper preservation and storage. Dan Strebel is professor of cinema studies at NYU. Dan, welcome.
Hello.
So, Dan, burned is actually relevant here because the original formats were actually quite flammable, and that's part of the problem here.
Yeah, definitely. It's almost all movies, motion picture film made before 1950 was made on nitrate stock, very highly flammable and famously chemically unstable after a certain period of time. It would start to decompose on its own, but it also, if it caught fire, you could not extinguish it.
And there's no sort of backup. There's no, you know, hard drive to yes. find the images.
Well, hopefully, you know, if a print of a film was burned in a projector, the maker would have a negative somewhere to make a new print. But that wasn't done regularly for decades and decades.
Well, as a cinema studies professor, what have we lost in terms of cultural treasure here?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we're talking about the numbers here, so whether you put the number at 70 or 80% of all American silent feature films, which is the latest statistic, we're talking about losing a visual and a sonic record in some cases of not just photographically what was documented, which was quite extraordinary, what was documented all over the country, all over the world, but also, you know, every way that most people took in popular culture. This in the 1920s, this was the high point of movie going in American culture. Far more percentage of American public went to movies regularly than at any point in history in the late 20s. So what they were seeing, their daily diet of what they viewed, how they saw the world, how they saw other people, we can, if we're interested in that, which I think most people are, 80% of what we might look at, that they looked at, we can't see, so we can't know. So all we can do is read descriptions.
And part of what was going on back then in the silent era was a transition from other media to this new motion picture media and figuring out what it was for. I mean, there was everything from aim a camera at a ballet to really experimental sort of art pieces and then just the storytelling that we understand, like Charlie Chaplin, for instance.
Yeah, no, there was a wide diversity of applications of movies, as you say, not just the Hollywood feature film, but millions of feet of newsreel footage were exposed all over the planet, recording the world as never recorded before. Lots of even amateur home movies started in the 1920s. People started making their own films, as well as commercials and documentaries and newsreels, animation, as you said, experimental, the really high moment for modern art in the 1920s. And most modern artists were interested in making films.
In your dream list of films you would want to be able to see, in the technology that might be available even yet to preserve what we still have, is there a place where you can go and experience silent films? Is there a place that's done a particularly good job of it? And is there hope for seeing things that maybe we consider lost today?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to take one really, really recent example, even though it's not silent era film, is a silent film that Orson Welles shot in 1938. And never publicly exhibited, and it was just assumed that it would never be seen. And then this year, George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, unveiled an almost hour-long pristine print of this film, which Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten shot all over Manhattan. Really, really interesting documentation of what New York looked like, both down at the Battery and on the West Side and at the North Island of Manhattan. It was phenomenal. It was like watching in a time machine when I saw the film projected, because it was so crystal clear, the image. It was totally unscratched. And the fact, you know, we knew something about the people who made the film, and this is the film Orson Welles made before, 3 years before he made Citizen Kane. It was really astonishing. So the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, is one of the most important silent film archives. The Library of Congress by far does the biggest volume of work in terms of saving American film heritage.
And around the world?
You mean in other archives?
Other archives around.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing about the study that the Library of Congress just published, is that aside from the Library of Congress and the other major American archives, most American silent films that do survive, survive in places like the Czech National Film Archive, the Russian National Film Archive, the British, they're all over the world. And the most exciting thing is that in the past several years, some of the biggest discoveries have been made now that people are paying attention to other places. So a lost film that Alfred Hitchcock co-directed or worked on was found in New Zealand. The director's cut of Fritz Lang's Metropolis was found in Argentina. So films circulated around the planet in a really amazing way in the 20s. These heavy, bulky nitrate prints would, by the time they got to the end of the run in Argentina or New Zealand, it was too expensive to ship them back, so the studios didn't ask them to come back. And so you never know where you're going to find these treasures.
So you could dare to dream that in your email box when you get to your office, there could be another...
Yes, please, please.
...discovery.
No, it's true. Amazing things are uncovered all the time, and... You know, there's a short list of well-known things that people want. They want Eric von Stroheim's Uncut Greed. They want the complete Orson Welles Magnificent Ambersons, things like that. And maybe those things will never turn up. But boy, I'm still amazed at what does keep turning up, and sometimes how great a physical condition it still is in.
He sounds a bit like an archaeologist, but in fact, he's a professor of cinema studies at NYU. Dan Strebel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
So on quite the other end of the spectrum, technologically speaking, we have been noting the migration of the Christmas holidays into a compact and convenient digital package of shopping clicks and holiday alerts, caroling via Facebook and Vine. I love how you have all responded to rewriting some of these Christmas carols to reflect our digital reality just a bit.
Oh, Christmas tweet, you mean to boost inclusion. Oh, Christmas tweet, but you can cause intrusion. At midnight mass, when in my pew, I want no Christmas bells from you. Oh, Christmas tweet, my Christmas phone is muted.
Absolute genius from our listeners. And of course, that's Sarah in Minneapolis. Sarah, your Minneapolis, Minnesota choral training has certainly not gone to waste. No, please call again. In a more retro vein, some of you gave us some of your golden rules for the holidays, not necessarily digital. Morristown, New Jersey, one of my holiday rules, don't drink too much around my coworkers or my boss. That's pretty smart. Osterville, Mass, remember what the season is about, love and respect, sharing and joy, not trampling each other down at the mall. Notes and parties should be fun things. Change your perspective on them. If you want to be invited back, always bring a hostess gift, says one of you from Little Rock, Arkansas. And just one rule, no gifts except for family. All gifts do is create obligation and disappointment. That's from one of you in Salt Lake City, Utah. We have many more of these golden rules to share, but let me welcome in Anna Post, author and etiquette expert and the great-great-granddaughter of the Queen of Etiquette, Emily Post. Anna, it's great to have you right here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So does the digital transformation of the holidays require a rethinking of etiquette and politeness? There's a tendency to use digital to kind of make the holidays more convenient, but you could end up offending someone.
You know, that's the key word right there is convenience. And the holidays need some convenience.
Yes.
I like being able to take care of some things online, even if it's finding about a local shop having a sale down the street. That's great. The key is you can't make convenience the priority over the people. You know, I loved that little tweet song that just came in from
so
one of the listeners.
Yeah,
that was so brilliant. And what I love about it is that, you know, there's the right time for that convenience and the wrong time, whether it's, you know, in her case at Mass or if it regardless of your religion, it doesn't matter, or if it is when you're spending time with family. That's what the holidays are really about. Somebody else kind of hit on that with gifts feeling like too much of an obligation. For me, etiquette is about relationships with people, and the holidays are a chance to really focus on that. So let those devices connect you when you're not around them, the people that you love, but when you are, make them the priority, put the phone away.
Let's do a little strategy here. Is there a category of relationships? Maybe they're professional, maybe they're sort of second or third tier, but still important. You want to remain in touch. Maybe it's a professional kind of thing. That it is appropriate to do a kind of group email as opposed to a holiday card or a real thank you note or something that involves your actual signature.
Oh, sure. You know, the genius of technology is that it gives us options. The part that we have to play in this is knowing when to pick which option for who, making sure it's appropriate. That's our job. The convenience, that's the job of the technology. So when we pair it and we get it right, I think it's a really great way to maintain and reach all those different relationships. Like you said, this could be work relationships that you're reaching out to where, you know, a card really might not be in the cards, so to speak. But getting an email out to somebody, it's a nice way to remember them at the holidays.
Do you like the card services that actually do more than just make it an email where you actually have to open up something and it's got some graphics and Does that work for you? Sometimes it feels like annoying, time-wasting junk mail to me.
Yeah, and that's the trick is, you know, who are you sending it to? If I get one of those from a friend, I'm probably going to be paying a little bit more attention to it than somebody that I really don't know very well in business. Now, that being said, I don't think it ever hurts to send one of those out. But you do also want to think about the human factor. You know, for example, there are sites out there where you can type in what you want to have it say and it'll print it in sort of like a Comic Sans type font and mail it off for you. I'm not as big a fan of that. That handwriting, that personal quirk is what really matters. You know, there's one thank you note app called Felt App that does a good job because you actually use a stylus on a tablet and it is your handwriting.
Right.
That's as close as I've seen to those really feeling more personal.
I'm a card nut. I can't ever give up the card and the picture around Christmas time. How about you?
I'm a big fan, I have to say. And yet every year I will completely admit my now fiance and I fail at getting our act together and getting something out to people. That being said, I absolutely love receiving them from people. It's a really nice thing to get in the mail in the middle of all the bills and the junk mail.
Right. And there's definitely plenty of that. Now, this is a real moving target. And I'm wondering if your great-great-grandmother is, you know, either saying, get it right because, you know, it's a new century and all the rules have to be rewritten, or if she's, you know, rolling over in her grave, we can know neither of those. But still, I remember not too long ago, probably a decade and a half ago, I did a story for NPR that was about people FedExing their gifts the day before Christmas. And the idea was, boy, these people are really either nuts or rich or just complete, like, space heads. Now that's, like, normal. There's something completely normal about that. I think a lot of this stuff, you know, you get your gifts from Amazon. People go, oh, well, they didn't really think about you. People don't really think that way so much anymore. It's working its way into our holiday sense of you can be both polite, caring, and have convenience.
I think that there is a lot of that. And, you know, I don't fault that. You know, I'm okay, for example, with a gift card if you really can't think of what's right for somebody to get. Now, if you know that your sister wants a certain sweater, yes, please go out and buy the sweater for your sister.
And if it's on Amazon, that's okay.
Yeah, and that's okay. And, you know, people are going to have a balance of how they shop. You know, I think there's that mix of the convenience and often savings online. And I think that there's a real awareness lately of shopping in your hometown. I'm really proud to do that. I'm from Burlington, Vermont, and I love doing that. So you get a mix.
It's like living in a Christmas card.
Vermont. I know. It's kind of unfair to everybody else. But you know, with that convenience, like I said, you've just got to remember that awareness of, am I just doing this because, you know, say ordering something online at the last minute because it's convenient, or is my heart really in this? That's the check-in.
You got to know if your heart is in it. Here are a couple of things from our listeners. Christmas is my mother's birthday, so making her happy is always a golden rule for me. That's from Orlando, Florida. Salem, Oregon. A lot of rules here. After Thanksgiving, I swap out the coffee creamer for Bailey's at holiday parties. While at family gatherings, my golden rule is to avoid political conversations with Uncle Jack. Make sure to kiss Aunt Amy or she will hunt me down all upset. Bring a guitar for my mother and make sure to use real butter in my potato casserole. Other than that, I just try to make sure we all remember what the holidays are all about, each other. Any rituals in your family that you have to avoid or step around when you get together?
We are a longstanding family who gets together, extended family, on Christmas afternoon. And we've done this for years. It was very Norman Rockwell when I was a kid up in Stowe, Vermont, with lots of, you know, snow and all of that. And that was the one thing that even when we had to get out of the car at the bottom of the driveway and trek up in our nice shoes, that was the one thing that we always, always did. But, you know, I think that focusing on traditions, and traditions can change too, same as etiquette, and that's okay. But be really thoughtful about what you leave behind. And be thoughtful about what you create, too, you know, as you maybe form a new family. This could be a great opportunity to start a new tradition.
Sounds like you have that on your mind a little bit with the fiancé there. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. Anna Post is an author, etiquette expert, great-great-granddaughter of the queen of etiquette, Emily Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And do you have rules you try to live by during the holiday season? Share your tips at 877-8-MY-TAKE and join our texting network. We love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.